The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight we speak with Bill Rabane on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Driving independent and underground film from the dawn of the talkies through the early 90s. Tonight we'll be speaking with Wisconsin's own one-man filmmaking industry, Bill Rabane, staying just one step ahead of the Soviet takeovers of Latvia, Estonia, and East Germany back in the 40s. Bill emigrated to the U.S., learning English from the movies, and quickly moving his way from mailroom to executive producer in 50s live television, as well as introducing a 360-degree film process to such industry heavyweights as Warner Brothers, Disney, MGM, and even Hugh Hefner. Establishing his own studio in the heartland of America, Rabane was responsible for such 70s and 80s cult classics as The Giant Spider Invasion, Capture of Bigfoot, Demons of Ludlow, and the creepy slasher Blood Harvest with none other than Tiny Tim. Join us as we speak to Bill Rabane, only here on Third Eye Cinema. We have with us today a man who's been involved in many aspects of the film industry, from working at prominent Midwest television network WGN in Chicago to film distribution and production to establishing his own studio and unique independent filmography right in the heartland of Wisconsin. Please join me in welcoming the one and only Bill Rabane. Bill, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Well, thank you, Gene. I am here and I'm alive.
I understand you actually didn't grow up here in the U.S. You were actually in Latvia and Estonia until your teens.
That's correct. I was born in Latvia, spent most of my young years in a horse and wagon train, just staying a little bit ahead of the rural communists over there, ending up in Germany and in 1952 in America.
So how different was the environment in those days? Because you emigrated at the height of the Cold War. I believe the Berlin Wall had already been erected and relations between the U.S. and the Slavic countries had become strained, to say the least.
Oh, very much so. It was a different world altogether. Something that I don't think most Americans have experienced. This is not a politically, I won't go into that.
You were actually residing in Germany during Operation Priboi, where Latvian patriots were deported to Siberia or sent to the gulags, and Estonia had been forcibly annexed by the Soviets as well. So how did your family manage to get out? Were you lucky enough to be situated at that time in West Germany, or were you in effect what was then known as defectors from the Soviets?
Well, we were escaping via horse and wagon in 44, but from Prussia to Poland into Germany, sometimes with the Russians just a very few miles behind us.
Wow.
We were fortunate to really escape that wrath of the communists at the time.
Exactly.
And ended up in Berlin during the Berlin bombing.
Wow.
And no sooner getting out of that, we got in further west into Hamburg, Germany, and that was still in flames, and they were picking up the bodies.
Wow.
It wasn't a very pleasant experience.
But you were actually right in time just to get out of every one of these countries.
Yeah, exactly. And we just, fortunately, we made it to Germany just as the end of the war, and the Brits and the Americans took over. They divided into the British and the American zone. We ended up in the British zone.
I also understand that when you had gotten over here to the U.S., you did the same thing as my wife in that you effectively learned English from, in her case it was television, but in your case it was movies. And this was also how you fell in love with film.
Yeah, that's very true. I was situated in Chicago and in a neighborhood that was on one side of 63rd Street. It was mostly immigrants from almost every European country you can imagine. And on the other side of 63rd Street, it was all black.
Right.
Fortunately, there was actually a wonderful growing up atmosphere. There was no conflict, racial conflict whatsoever. 63rd Street happened to have a lot of movie houses. Most of them were double bills, you know, or triple bills.
Right.
And I spent a good deal, if not all my time, in the theaters, watching one after another, sometimes half a day until my parents said, enough is enough. But that didn't stop me either. I just continued watching movies.
But what's fascinating about this is you really didn't have any English, and you just picked it up along the way from watching these films.
I did. I must have, because I didn't learn it anywhere else. It just seemed to get the ear for. Of course, prior to that, in my younger years as a child, I did speak a fluent Latvian, Estonian, and Russian. So maybe I just had an ear for it. And certainly the movies were the criteria that helped me get into the language.
And you must have also had some German as well, because I thought that you had done some schooling in German.
Oh, yeah, very much so. German became my main language as of 1945.
So how many years were you over there before you came to the U.S. in Germany?
There's 7 years, 45 to 52. We came over in 1952.
Wow. Fairly early on, you wound up working at WGN in Chicago, and actually did the hoary Horatio Alger American Dream cliche of working your way up literally from the mailroom staff to being an executive producer.
That was an incredible and enlightening and fantastic experience.
I imagine. So how did that work for you? Was it just everything just kept falling in your lap? You know, they just liked what you were doing and you just showed your initiative and went for it? Or how did this come about?
I think I answered the newspaper ad for a mailroom position at WGN at the Tribune.
Right.
And that was actually a follow-up to my going to the Chicago Theater for a year prior to that. Almost every performance at the Chicago Theater I used to see, because they combined a movie and a live show.
Wow.
And at for the live shows, of course, they had every conceivable star you can imagine of that in those days performing there. So my eyes got pretty big when I watched the live show. These are live shows, you know, Dorothy Lamour, Mickey Rooney, and Milton Berle. I mean, you name it, every major name performed, and then they would do the show and then show the movie, a movie after, a major picture after that.
Right.
So the stage door became a habit with a autograph book.
Right.
I would stand and get every autograph imaginable. So that kind of led me, when the WGN position was announced, that I applied, got the job, and jumped right into it. It was almost like a college education.
Wow. And how did you work your way up from mailroom to being an executive producer in so short of a time?
Well, I guess it had something to do with, first of all, I was a good communicator. People liked me. The cast of the various shows, the producing units, they liked me. I did a good job. I must have done a good job, because I had no problem progressing.
Right.
Until I became a special assistant to a producer out of New York who was a dramatic director as well, Leslie Erbach, who got me into a couple of live shows. And as his assistant, as an executive, I was able to learn pretty much the entire television business very quickly.
So going back to what you were saying about the live shows that they would put on at the theater, what kind of shows were they doing? Was this song and dance numbers? Was it comedy routines? Was it a bit of everything, like a USO show?
Well, there was one in particular called They Stand Accused, a courtroom drama show, where the first one I did, I think I had a couple of lines as a witness.
And you were actually involved with stars like Sid Charisse and Bob Hope and whoever else out on the stage at that age?
Well, and the marathons, when they had the, for instance, the Jerry Lewis marathons, and the stars came in to help raise money for muscular dystrophy, various came in. At that time, I was assigned to take care of them, or be their, the errand boy, so to say, to make sure that they were comfortable and what have you. Mickey Rooney in particular, I think it was one time Donald O'Connor, and so it was a very gratifying experience.
And I'm still fascinated at how you managed to just take a job, probably your first job in this country, as a mailroom person, and then just work your way right up to executive producer in so short a time. Because, you know, in those days it may have been different, but nowadays that really doesn't happen. They kind of compartmentalize you, and you might grow up to be, okay, you're a mailroom assistant today, and you're the head of the mailroom in a couple of years, but you're not going to become an executive producer. You know, that's like a cross-discipline. I'm really fascinated how that worked out for you.
I think it worked because I took a very special interest in the – I was absolutely fascinated with the entire operation of how it worked, the production worked. And even in my spare time, I would seldom go home after work. I would spend my time in the control room making not only friends but also observing everything that went on and how it went on.
Wow.
The first time I did a job as a floor manager, I was shaking in my boots because the timing, live shows, you know, the timing had to be exactly on by the second. You made one mistake, it went out over the air, and you were in deep shit, so to say.
Here's something a lot of people don't know when the name Bill Rabain is mentioned. You actually didn't invent it, but you were the first person who introduced the original wraparound 360-degree process to the film industry, and you had some showcases including power players like Sam Goldwyn of MGM, Jack Warner of Warner Brothers, Hugh Hefner, and the folks at Disney. Tell us a bit about this.
Well, that was strictly coincident. I decided to make a trip. I had to visit my ailing grandmother in Germany. I went back to Germany on a short trip, initially a first trip, and by coincidence met a German industrial producer by the name of Adalbert Baltus, who was heavy into, at that time, industrial films, but also had invented a circular motion picture process that was done with one camera and one projector, and he was, at that time, in 16 millimeter. I remember in an apartment in Hamburg, Germany, I was asked to look at a lampshade, a very large lampshade, and look
right
into it from underneath. And there was a little projector that projected against a prism that shot the picture up into the lampshade. And it was
right
fascinating because I could see a 360-degree image right inside of the lampshade. And he said, imagine this in large size, in regular movie screen size. Yeah, I was fascinated with it. And it led to the question of, well, he considered me an American now. Age, I think it was 1959. He says, would you represent the process over there? And I was fascinated by it. I took all the paperwork and the demonstration materials back with me and raised the money and put together a demonstration. My experience at WGN, I had made a lot of friends in Chicago in the business and was working with United Film and Recording Studios, which was one of the major commercial studios at the time, and got a break there too. A fellow by the name of Bill Klein, the owner, said you can have the studio to demonstrate this because he was also intrigued with the process. So long story short, I think it was a year later, I had raised some $250,000 and built the screen and obtained the projector, brought the inventor over, and at one point we gave a demonstration and a huge invitation list. I think all the cream of crop of Chicago money was gathered there and gave the first showing of a 360-degree process, one camera, one projector, and no scenes.
So this is like the equivalent of when they had Sensaround, where it was like a three-quarter screen, and you could look left, right, and middle, but actually going entirely around the theater. Now, I can't even picture how theaters would have to reset themselves up for this. You know, would people's seats have to swivel? I mean, there'd be a lot of money sunk into just setting up theaters to be able to show this process. So the whole thing is fascinating to me that this even happened and that, you know, the power players were really interested in this.
Well, Disney had the process called Circarama going at that time.
Right.
Circarama was a 360-degree screen with 16 projectors and scenes between each projection screen. However, they were still cleaning up with it at Disneyland or at wherever they showed it in California. Roy Disney showed up and at the screening and was very congenial and was extremely interested in the process. There was a technical problem that arose in the enlargement of the entire gimmick, if you want to call it that, or process.
Right.
There was no projector made that would project vertically at that time, and still isn't. 35 Arben Arc projectors projected horizontally, so we had to project first horizontally against a prism, an optically clear prism, that would shoot the picture upward. The cost of a vertical vertical projector at that time was William DeVry, the owner of DeVry Institute in Chicago, and DeVry Projectors worked with us to accomplish that, but the costs were just phenomenal.
Beyond all this, even if you had gotten the process working seamlessly and that people had bid, wasn't there an issue with the rights owner?
No, not at all. Mr. Baltus owned the rights worldwide, and we had a buyer who was willing to buy the entire rights worldwide, globally, and there was an advance of $2 million. And the inventor said, yeah, well, with the worldwide rights, there is one little problem he brought up. What's the little problem? The problem was that about 2 years earlier, when the process was in its infinity, he had assigned some rights to a fellow by the name of Jean Boucher in Paris, France, who happened to be one of the wealthiest men in France, by the name of Jean Boucher. He owned the Lido, the Moulin Rouge, casinos in Marrakesh, Morocco, you name it. Extremely wealthy man who had the basically had the rights to France for the process. So, and what we did is when we found that out, which was a little late, unfortunately, a lawyer that I had, who was at that time a former professor of the University of Northwestern for a law school professor, who was 82 at the time, we all flew over to France, to Paris, to convince Mr. Boucher to relinquish rights. Mr. Boucher had his own ideas and was ready to build a big bubble theater in both in France and Marrakesh, Morocco. I mean, he was, while he was very congenial and treated us like gold, he was absolutely unwilling to relinquish his French rights. After about a year of this little bit of hiccup, I ran out of cash, and it was difficult because it needed too much cash to continue promoting it.
I understand that your experiences with Hollywood and the business end of things out there during all this is what drove you to set up your own independent film studio in Wisconsin?
Well, there's lots of stuff in between there, of course. I had decided after the Cineterium process, which I think was very successful, it did get them out. I had decided to go right into something I knew very little about, is directing and producing. But ideas were everything, and they still are today. If you have a good idea, you got to follow it. So I came up with the idea to do a musical short subject. Yeah, Twist Craze was the first. It was a 10-minute short subject. I wasn't quite oiled enough to direct it, so I asked a friend, Alan David, to direct it for me.
Right.
We put it together, and lo and behold, it became one of the most successful short subjects of that era.
All of your films were actually pretty successful, correct? Because I understand, for example, Giant Spider Invasion grossed $23
million? $24 million, according to that. I didn't know about it until I heard it on the Johnny Carson show.
And this is $1975. That's a lot of money.
That was it was kind of beyond comprehension for me at the time.
And that wasn't your only production that did well. I think all of your films actually raked in a decent amount of cash for you.
Well, they did produce some excellent grosses. About cash, to me, that's another question.
Oh, that's true. I do understand that money has to go to various parts of the process. So you were involved with producing, like you were just mentioning, 1962's Twist Craze. You were the executive producer there. And that was a fun short that shows up on several Something Weird DVDs. It's basically just a dinner theater full of people watching a surf rock band. And then another guy comes out and does some acrobatic twisting. And finally, most of the audience joins him on stage. You then followed this with Dance Craze from the same year, which you both produced and this time directed. And this shows up, again, on several Something Weird discs in the extras, including the one for Monster A Go-Go. This one's basically just a bunch of people of all ages twisting at various crowded nightclubs with some sarcastic narration and some burlesque-style comedy inserts. It's actually one of my wife's favorite of these sort of shorts. This whole midsection where this fat guy hurts himself twisting and hobbles over to the doctor's office, winds up dreaming of dances through the years from waltzes to the Charleston, and then you showcase a few bands. I really like the self-conscious artificiality of it in the film style and the limited sets. It makes the experience all the more surreal. There was a really nice shot that you did through a beer glass that gets carried off screen to reveal one of the bands doing an Elvis-style twist song. What inspired these two? What was the intended market for shorts like this? Because these days, it just seems like, you know, these are like beamed in from a different planet because there's no point of reference.
Well, in those days, remember, short subjects were still part of the menu for major theaters and major productions because they all needed, sometimes pictures ran short. Instead of the 90 minutes, they might run at 70 minutes, 75. They all needed short, added attraction. And I guess we lucked out. It was inspired by me because most of the movies I admired most was musicals. Every Donald O'Connor musical I saw, and I was going to follow in the footsteps of that type genre film and proceeded with that. So Dance Grease was the first, actually, that I did all of it. But as a matter of fact, I sang the song. I wrote and sang the song for Cinderella Was There, I think was the song.
Really? Okay. Because, I mean, on screen, they actually showed a band doing that, so I thought it was them. Or was this the one during the waltzes?
That was the slow one.
Okay.
Yeah, I wrote that song because at that time I was also part-time. I was singing at night. I was singing in every German nightclub there was in Chicago and having special promotions as a singer and entertainer.
So were you singing all cabaret stuff, like Lottie Lenya and Marlene Dietrich?
All the good old German stuff. And I had to cut out a niche for me to go a little further with the singing, so that's why I wrote the song Cinderella Was There and performed it in Dance Craze. In Dance Craze, both of those short subjects, by the way, were returned about, I would say, not only 500% of their budgets.
What led you from, you know, you were saying that you weren't comfortable directing yet when you did Twist Craze and you had the friend do the direction and you just produced it. What led you to direct it on Dance Craze?
Well, I had worked with, I think I was capable of directing Twist Craze, but I just didn't trust myself. So I just simply decided I'm going to tackle it and do Dance Craze myself. With all the support that was there, it was, you remember, full union crews, 35mm shooting. I know that there were a lot of professionals that supported me, and it was pleasant. That was a pleasant experience, Dance Craze.
Yeah, and like I said, I was really impressed with the styling of it, and some of the shots were really well framed, like that one I mentioned with the beer glass and the reveal. Where did you come up with these? You must have picked them up from other movies you were watching, or?
Yes, everything is a manifestation in your head from things you've either seen or experienced on the screen in earlier days.
Like you were mentioning, both of these films actually became huge hits for you, and they brought you into contact and deal-making with people like Sam Arkoff of AIP and the vice president of Universal Pictures.
Yes, they did. Matter of fact, Hy Martin, who was not at that time president of Universal, was a friend of Mr. Silverman's, who owned the Oriental Theater in Chicago.
Right.
And they communicated, and Hy Martin suggested that Twist Craze be nominated for an Academy Award.
Wow.
And we had the prerequisites for an award was three showings, one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast, and one in the Midwest in Chicago,
right,
prior to a certain date. We met the dates in Chicago and in Los Angeles, but we could not get a date within that time frame for New York.
Oh.
But other than that, that was the issue, and came pretty close to getting at least a nomination.
Wow, that's impressive. I didn't even know that one. You got one on me already.
You listen to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Bill Rabane. We'll be discussing several things here on Third Eye Cinema.
Coming up, we'll be discussing Ronald Reagan, Monster a Go-Go, Herschel Gordon Lewis and the Move to Wisconsin, industrial films, Giant Spider Invasion and Liquor, Mystery Science Theater, and the Retromedia lawsuit. I understand that your experiences with Hollywood, which probably was all this deal-making that you were involved with here, as well as what you were doing with the 360-degree process, and the business end of things out there, is what drove you to set up your own independent film studio in Wisconsin.
Well, that also was experiences in Chicago. Chicago after Dance Craze and Twist Craze, proceeded to get involved and said I wanted to make a horror movie, I mean a science fiction picture, and it was called Terror at Half Day.
Right.
And we raised $50,000 to make Terror at Half Day. I garnered June Travis and Peter Thompson to do the leads. We went ahead and shot about a week and a half of the picture, and
right.
The union, however, unfortunately took all the money that we raised, mandating that I have it controlled by them and use a union crew.
Oh.
Which it sank the picture even before it began.
Wow.
Because you cannot shoot a picture like that, a low budget science fiction movie, on location as an independent and have a union crew that is stuck to working 8 hours a day when it took 6 hours a day to set up. We went at a golden time. It was just like the mob standing over you saying, you do this or else.
Wow. And so, Chicago is very much a union town. It's because I understand that Herschel Gordon Lewis also had some issues with that.
Oh, yeah. He was shooting prime time at one time. And at the same studio, he officed at the same studio I did, United Film and Recording, and the union, which was more like the mob,
right.
They came in and ready to break in the doors and break his neck.
Wow.
We went through the same, almost the same experience, but I was chicken. I said, okay, I'll give in. He said, you take the money, just give me what I need. Well, they didn't.
So
the picture was not finished, although right. I had a lot of production values in it, because
right.
Mayor was an acquaintance. He gave me almost everything that a filmmaker could use
right.
for making a picture in Chicago. We blocked off Michigan and Oak Street during rush hour traffic at one point.
Wow.
Which is unheard of, and I don't understand why Chicago's archives don't have this experience in it, because it was a monumental task and experience. One fire engine, the Civil Defense Union, all the Chicago cops from the 1st District racing up and down Michigan Avenue and underneath Wacker Drive for production values. That was, I think, the first real experience of city cooperation a movie maker could have.
Sure. Speaking of Terror of Half Day, at one point you actually had Ronald Reagan slated to star, but that fell apart on you.
Yes. We met Ronald Reagan. That was I think there are several articles out on that meeting. I don't know if they popped up a few times on the internet, but it was an absolutely wonderful meeting. The man was incredibly sympathetic and friendly. And we got into had a good rapport, and because June Travis, who he was very familiar with from his radio days in Hollywood,
right.
got him to say, I'm very interested. I would like to look at the script. I want to continue this conversation. And we did. But at the same time, I think at that time there was some inkling at the talk about his running for governor of California. And because of the time frame in the last minute, June Travis obtained the association with Peter Thompson, who was ready and willing and able to go. Oh, and the investors that I went to for Ronald Reagan said, we're not investing in this because he's a has-been. He'll never make a dime at the box office.
Wow.
Now, that was the upshot of that one. The investors just kept denying or didn't want Ronald Reagan simply because there's no way they thought I could make money with Ronald Reagan.
It's fascinating, but
yeah.
Still. So
Reagan had also done the GE Theater series. He was just dropping from the star sky down to a little less of exposure as some of the other big stars in Hollywood. But the investor really put the damper on that.
Yeah, and yet they preferred the guy that you had starred in the role, who was, I believe, someone of an unknown at the time, correct? He didn't have the name power that Reagan did.
No, absolutely. No comparison. Peter Thompson had done, I think, Adventures in Paradise, in the TV series. And he had a window of, I think it was 5 days of shooting. And there was no way. We didn't finish within 5 days with him because of...
So it's like this project was doomed. You were attacked on several different sides.
It was. Finally, put a lid on that. At one point, Herschel Lewis said, well, I need a picture for a double bill for, I think it was Moonshine Mountain Distribution, and I gave him the footage. I said, you finish it, and whatever you want to do with it, just get distribution for it.
Right.
And that was basically the end of it. 4 years later, after I was in Wisconsin, I saw the picture under Monster of Gogo, and I wanted to puke.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how Herschel got involved, because once he made it into Monster of Gogo, the end result was a bit of a mess, with several characters vanishing or being swapped with different actors, mostly in the same roles, and a whole lot of dancing to pad things out. So I was going to say, how much of the final film was actually still your footage as opposed to what Herschel had added?
Well, unfortunately, there was a great deal of all the production value, the action footage, the Michigan stuff, the underwater action stuff, that
right.
was all at all disappeared. I have no idea where that footage. Because of that, Herschel, I guess, resorted to whatever he could do to save the picture.
Right.
But it certainly was not in my directorial effort.
Exactly.
By any means.
Because it does not feel like any of your other films. So you actually ran a few studios during this time as well. One in Germany, which is actually one where they shot John Lennon's How I Won the War, and one you founded in Wisconsin, the Shooting Ranch.
Well, I was introduced to my friend, the studio owner in Germany, Studio Bendisdorf, during the time of the Baltus 360-degree process situation. And we became very close friends. I became the American representative for the studio as a whole to get co-productions into the studio there.
Right.
And that fills the hole between the early 60s and my moving to Wisconsin. Because I became an associate producer for Columbia's The Final Guns, a World War II story, the Battle of the Ardennes. Tony Lazzarino, producer, who previously had done the X-15, the Sinatra picture. And I brought that picture, I took that picture and brought it over to the studio in Germany through some pretty wild experiences in the production of that. Lazzarino turned out to be a megalomaniac and was always short on money, and our studio in Germany advanced all the technical aspects for the production. We were deep in shit financially to help out that production. Columbia
right.
had, I don't know, about $1 million or so in the production. We were getting deeper into the hole with it. So long story short, I left not getting paid for the services over in Europe, and I was gone for too long.
Oof.
I came back to Chicago, and I said, this whole Hollywood bullshit is bullshit.
Right.
And running a little low on money myself, I said, I'm going to go into the woods, some north woods somewhere, and do something interesting, take my family to a better place than Chicago. And that's basically the reason why we moved to Wisconsin.
Right.
I bought a farm with no intentions of actually returning to do anything in film except write. Fortunately, I had a very close friend from the WGN days, Jerry Gregoris, who was a producer at WGN,
right.
and had a tremendous amount of clients for industrial production. He put me onto jobs for both directing, shooting, and post-production on a number of industrial films for major clients, which
right.
I commuted from my farm in Wisconsin. I went wherever he sent me to do the shoot or whatever. That gave me the basis, the foundation, and the money to start the operation in Wisconsin.
With the exception of the dance shorts and the abandoned third half day, your film career in terms of actual feature films really began in the mid-70s with Invasion from Inner Earth, which unfortunately is one of the few of your films that I've never been able to find a copy of. Why do you think your films have either been relegated to budget multi-film sets or just plain impossible to find? Because, I'd appreciate seeing special editions or twofers of your films, particularly since the multi-sets tend to grab VHS copies rather than, nice masters from actual prints.
I don't know how that happened. Of course, there's been so much piracy in the last 15 years. I lost control of almost all pictures for over 14 years.
Ouch.
And it took all of the last 10 years to clean some of that up and to get back gather the copyrights and some of the materials back.
So does that mean you're planning on releasing them through your own site at some point? Mastering them and getting them out on some sort of special edition DVDs?
Absolutely, right. That's what we're doing with Independent Artist Pictures, which is the same company, by the same company name that I created for Twist Craze and Dance Craze.
That's right. Wow. So you're nodding to the past as well as moving towards the future. Then you did the Giant Spider Invasion, which was a staple of syndicated TV throughout my childhood and teens before winding up spoofed on Mystery Science Theater 3000. Tell us a bit about this one. How did you wind up casting the always likable Skipper, Alan Hale Jr., and his wife Barbara, who is best known as Della Street from Perry Mason, for this one? I understand Alan's father was a drinking buddy of yours at one point?
Well, no, Alan himself, Jr., was a so-called drinking buddy. I wish I would have known his dad. But Steve Brody became a very close friend of mine. By that time, I had made so many trips to Hollywood, and dealt with so many studio people and stars because right. of my connection with and representation for studio Bendersdorf in Hamburg, that it was relatively easy to interest someone in something that I was personally doing at my own operation in Wisconsin.
Was it just because it's breaking away from a Hollywood system, they can go out and have, you know, more peaceful time just working out in the Midwest, you know, a more bucolic setting? Or was it just because they knew you and they just wanted to work with you? Or,
well, they knew me, and in those days, the mentality in Hollywood was totally different. There were so many stars, including my good friend Bob Morris and John Wayne's brother with Bat Jack Productions. They were all independently oriented.
Right.
In other words, their own thing, and then they went to the studios and said, we've got a deal, we want you to participate, and that's how they operated.
That's true.
So when somebody that had a knack to raise money came along, which was me, I guess, at the time, it wasn't hard to get somebody interested and say, I will take a shot, take a chance
but
with you.
It's great that you have, you know, Alan Hale in there, because he's effectively still in character from Gilligan's Island. I mean, he even says, hey, little buddy, one or more times in the film.
I must tell you that the success of that picture lies greatly with my dear friend who just passed, Robert Easton. Robert first looked at the first script that Richard Tough and Madison, who had never written a screenplay before, and
right.
is now a professor of writing at the university, Richard Tough. Easton read the script and said, forget it, Bill, this will never fly the way it is. He says, we got to make it something different. We got to insert some tongue-in-cheek humor into this and camp stuff, because you can't take it serious. And I agreed with him, and we basically wrote the script and the lines that we see today, and that was all impromptu stuff.
It's much appreciated, and you're exactly right, especially at that time in cinema. If you ever put out something that was supposed to be, you know, sci-fi or, you know, a superhero type thing like a Flash Gordon or something, you really had to throw in some humor to it, because otherwise the audience just wouldn't accept it. You know, they thought they were, you know, more artsy and above it. And, you know, it wasn't like today where it's more of a populist medium. It was more people that were artsy and thought that they were above a lot of this stuff. So that was actually a really good move, particularly at the time, and even today, because otherwise we probably still wouldn't be talking about it as a cult classic film if it had been just a straight, you know, sci-fi horror film.
No, never. It would have never happened. And the other issue, of course, was the how to construct the distributor, Brandon Chase, from the very beginning, who was involved, said, how big are the spiders? I said, they're, I figure, about 3 feet or so. He said, no, they got to be bigger than Jaws.
So,
increasing the size of the spider until he finally had advertised that we're going to have a 30-foot spider in it. Well, how in the hell do a 30-foot spider with no budget for special effects?
And I was actually going to get to that, because one effect that I always found quite amusing was the giant spider that terrorized the parade, where it was basically just set up on top of a Volkswagen and the legs would move a little.
Yeah, it took all the way while we were in production already and shooting. The spider was being created and made by a local welder. I had no idea what the hell this was going to look like when we finally got to the spider scenes. So basically, I was kind of stuck with what I got. And then best of it.
Well, that's it. And it actually is something that's memorable that today we're still talking about. The film itself was quite memorable. I always appreciated the more humanistic approach of films at the time, where the focus was more on the townsfolk and the relationships and, you know, the comedy or drama of their daily lives, I guess, than just the menace that they face. And I think that nowadays films have sort of devolved where it's all spectacle without any real human element.
Well, there were other issues that entered into making a picture in those days, and that was alcohol. Everybody loved to, there were no drugs, but there was lots of booze, and Steve Brody was famous for that.
Yeah, that was actually my next question. You anticipated that one, too. As that, I understand a good portion of the cast was actually drunk throughout the filming. So what sort of challenges does this create for you as director and producer when basically your entire cast and crew are drunk, three sheets to the wind?
It was a nightmare. The people that were totally straight and never touched a drop, Alan Hale, Robert Easton, and Barbara Hale.
Really?
Steve Brody and Williams, they started it, and then the crew got into it.
I would have thought that Alan Hale would have been one of the first ones, because he seems like the kind of guy that you would catch, you know, hanging around at a bar, like a good time party guy. And also, I had known that he was one of your drinking buddies in the past.
Alan Hale, yeah, well, he could belt a couple, but he would not let that interfere in his career or acting.
So he's very professional.
He couldn't put up when the lines, but somebody didn't feed him the lines properly because they were slurring him.
Right.
What the heck was he supposed to do? He lost track of what he's supposed to do. There were a number of scenes at the end where we just almost gave up. My wife at the University of Chicago, we went up to the planetarium. On every tier of the stairs, the windowsills, there were cups. And these cups were all filled with just clear vodka.
Oh, wow.
They were these glasses that he set up and took with him all the time.
I was going to ask you, wasn't there some incident with Steve Brody towards the end of the film where he had to run down a hill and he was so drunk you were afraid that he was going to hurt himself because he was not really in control of his own body at that point?
He almost had a heart attack because it was 105 degrees that day. The carcass of the cows were steaming.
Right.
And he had to do some physical. He had probably a fifth of whiskey in him. And he had to run down a hill and stumble. Well, that was a little too much for him. We really thought we were going to lose him.
Wow. How did you take Mystery Science Theater 3000 send up of the film? And for that matter, Monster a Go-Go? Because I know some directors and actors love what they do and the exposure it gives to their films. But others take it really personally, like, for example, Joe Don Baker, who famously swore to beat the hell out of the cast if you ever ran into them. How did you take this?
Well, this may come as a shock to you, but there are two issues here that weigh heavy into the scene, and that is I never licensed, nor did anybody else, Mystery Science Theater until 2005.
When they did the DVDs?
Yes. Never had a license to either use the picture or Mystery Science Theater. Best Brain in Minneapolis did it on their own and without a license. So therefore, I have not received any royalties whatsoever from the very beginning of Mystery Science Theater.
Even with the DVDs?
Not even from the DVDs.
Wow.
After I, so to say, caught them in 2005, they sent me a contract for a buyout.
Right.
Well, I gave them the picture for a buyout worldwide for that purpose only as of 2005.
Right.
Still trying to get royalties prior to that.
Wow. And what was the other issue? You said there's two issues involved.
Well, it was strictly piracy.
But in terms of beyond, you know, not getting paid for the rights on this, what was the other issue involved with Mystery Science and how you took this?
Well, I licensed two films to Retro Media DVD distribution in the year 2000. And they inadvertently sold Giant Spider Invasion, a DVD box set,
right?
Mystery Science Theater without authority.
Okay, because I was actually just going to get to that one, too. What was that whole brouhaha between yourself and Fred Olin Ray over Retro Media's release of the Giant Spider Invasion? Because there was actually a very public court case involved with that. So this was involved with Mystery Science as well?
To a degree, yes, because they accepted a licensing deal from Retro Media when Retro Media had no authority to do that.
Wow.
But it was mostly an issue the first 3 years of distribution with Retro Media. There were no accountings or no accounting and reporting whatsoever. Subsequently, I canceled the agreement, send a cease and desist unless I get an accounting. They did not send one, and for 12 years, I never did get an accounting from them.
Wow.
And a Nightmare, I licensed to them Nightmare, which was also known as Blood Harvest.
Right.
And they released the picture as Blood Harvest, which I did not license to them. They're inviting and changing the campaign, which is a violation of the Lanham Act.
Right.
So therefore, they invited the problem of legal actions, basically. From there on, because of an arbitration clause in all the Hollywood contracts, common practice, I was kind of helpless in a sense because I could not afford arbitration nor go to California to fight the issue.
Right.
I filed an action in our local court here, which has no jurisdiction over Hollywood. So I succumbed to the arbitration in Hollywood, which calls for a show all by its own, Gene, actually.
Right.
That was a mess, and I, you know, anybody can call it miscarriage of justice, but that's pretty much what it was.
Right.
It was unnecessary, still wrongdoings and still corrections that need to be made, but it's over, and it's typical. These things happen all the time.
Yeah. No, it's Hollywood is famous for this stuff, especially when you get involved in independent film, because distributors and, you know, there's all sorts of things with record keeping and accounting and, you know, the filmmakers themselves not seeing a penny while distributors get rich. And, yeah, I totally understand.
tournament with our special guest tonight, Bill Rabane. Coming up, we discuss the Alpha Incident, Lana, how Shatner came up with the Kingdom of the Spiders, and the capture of Bigfoot financing the platform. And you're on Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, guys and girls. My name is Niko Mastorakis, and if it's all Greek to you, Google me. I have written, produced, and directed several movies, not all of them good movies, some of them very good movies, but more interesting than the movies themselves is a lengthy interview at Third Eye Cinema. If you miss it, you don't like movies.
Then you self-released a special edition of Giant Spider Invasion, but I believe it's only been available through your site or through Amazon. Has the release been successful?
Well, I just received, you know, after 34 years, I just took possession of all negative materials worldwide on Giant Spider Invasion. I just got the negative back, all of it. All of the foreign versions, Italian, German, Spanish, and you name it, are in Europe right now. That just happened 6 months ago. So we will be releasing it in HD. Nightmare is already in definition.
And you plan to do this with your other films as well?
Absolutely.
Is it going to be the same deal where they're basically just available through your website and Amazon?
No, we're in the process right now of making some deals for international and VOD and some of the majors, Giant Spiders specifically.
In other words, what you're saying here is that anybody who hasn't already picked up the special edition from you may be better off waiting for the Blu-ray version?
Either way, we're going to go for the HD, of course.
Okay, so moving on from that, then you had Rana, Legend of Shadow Lake, which was perplexingly retitled by Troma for its multi-pack DVD releases, Croaked Frog Monster from Hell. I'm surprised that distributors are still retitling films in this day and age, because in the VHS days, it made films so hard to find. You never knew what title it was going to be under.
Well, this is an interesting situation, too. When I became ill in 88, I sold two negatives to Troma at the Capture Bigfoot and Rana. Do not know to this date, because I don't have the paperwork, if I sold the intellectual rights with it. So we just did a director's cut of Rana. I looked at it a couple of weeks ago, done by my editor in Wisconsin, who did a phenomenal job of, it's a little bit shorter, but it's an excellent cut that was similar to the first cut I made during the making of the picture right after that. I'm fighting with myself as to whether to release it as a director's cut, because I still don't know. I try to get a hold of Lloyd Kaufman to find out and work, and they don't seem to be able to find much either. But I'll tell you, it's a much better rendition and very smooth, a good picture, actually.
I was going to say that Ron was actually one of your slower films. With the whole thing about mysterious swamp monsters and Indian legends, I really thought I'd be in for a corker, but it was a little more bland than I'd come to expect from a Bill Rabane movie. Why did you have that unusual structure where much of the film was told in flashback?
Oh, I think I can only say it was just one of those things where we thought we'd make a little... It was meant to be more a family-oriented, not a horror monster movie, so to say.
That probably explains it.
On that subject, Gene, Nightmare was the only picture that I recall making excessive. It had nudity, blood and gut. It was still not my style.
No, it wasn't.
I wasn't into a lot of blood, guts, and horror, as one sees from pretty much all the films.
Exactly, right.
I had a good friend, Leszek Brzezinski, who was the producer of the picture,
right,
and a distributor standing behind me. We got to give him, Bill, you got to give him more blood and guts. Actually, during the throat slicing scenes, I was a DP on it. I turned the camera on, turned my back on it, and said, okay, go roll it.
Right, you didn't want to deal with it.
Wasn't my cup of tea.
Right.
The nudity, I don't care. That's fine. I don't mind nudity at all. That's the European thinking. Who cares?
Right. Exactly.
But the excessive blood and gut stuff is something that is not my style, nor did I go after that, nor did I
want to. Right, and we'll get to that film in a bit, but it's true. That is definitely a departure from the usual Bill Rabane film. The Alpha Incident, which was your next film after Rana, was great. I really like these sort of siege mentality films like, you know, Night of the Living Dead. And you've got George Buck Flowers for this one as well, and as a seedy, ill-mannered trucker. I found this film fairly tense for what amounts to a single-location shoot, because the bulk of the film's actually confined to that one room, I believe it's the sheriff's office.
It's Alpha is my favorite film because I was able to do what I really wanted to do and explore the challenge of being able to take four people, put them into a isolated, basically one-room location and sustain the suspense and action for the entire picture.
And that's actually what I really liked about that.
It was a tremendous challenge, and I just still, I cringe at all kinds of things when I look at the old stuff. But if you have a limited budget, you have so much time, you have so much to work with,
exactly.
You do the best.
Exactly, you know, and that's not one of these things. I know some people don't pick on these films for whatever. I don't really care. I'm not really like that. And something's particularly funny, I'll point it out. But, you know, I'm more impressed with the fact that you guys got out there and did this stuff, and it's still there for us today for the most part. You know, some people can just get lost or don't get the DVD releases or whatever. But basically, the fact that you just actually went out there, hoisted up your bootstraps, and made something like this is what impresses me. I still find these kind of films to be much more entertaining than the kind of stuff that Hollywood puts out nowadays. So I'm on the same page as you here. I was actually rather impressed by how you managed to sustain the tension and, if you want to say suspense, but, you know, the characterization throughout the entire film with these couple of people just in this one room. It's almost like a Hitchcockian effort in a smaller independent sense, obviously.
Well, one thing I was very strict about is to have at least some semblance of a story and character development in something.
Right, exactly.
Just doing for the sake of a monster, for the sake of an exploitation effect here or there. Substance, there has to be some substance to a story.
Yeah, and that's what I was saying earlier about modern films, that we seem to have lost that. Whereas when people were making independent films in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, especially the 70s, there was a lot more focus on that sort of, you know, the meat of the matter was actually the characterization and the people involved, the human element. And then you threw in a monster or whatever for the exploitation value and to get people in the theaters. Whereas now, there really isn't any of that. It's all just, oh, here's a monster, here's a superhero, here's an alien, whatever. And here's a lot of explosions and, you know, CGI fights and effects and whatever else. And that stuff is nice, but for me at least, it doesn't sustain interest. You know, I don't say, oh, let's go see this because there's a lot of explosions. I don't care. You know, I want to see a story that's going to get me interested. I want to care about the characters involved. And I really don't get that from Hollywood nowadays.
Well, Hollywood has changed, and the young crowd, and I have a lot of students I work with and coach filmmakers, and I get a lot of submissions, and some of the stuff is just not palatable, or I don't know where the... Well, there must be an audience for it, because...
It's the same audience that makes fun of films like this, because they're saying, oh, they're too slow, nothing's happening. Well, yeah, but you're missing the point. There is something happening, it's not just what you're looking for.
We're coming out with a director's cut,
right,
of 6 or 7 pictures, all of them actually, for a special edition drive-in theater days package box set.
So that's going to be most of your films, yeah?
Right. It'll be given a lot of careful thought. It's nostalgic. It's good entertainment, I think. And that should be ready end of May or something.
Really? How you're doing this through your site again?
Yeah, and we're shooting, in 2 weeks we start shooting a wraparound on it, which is both a contemporary approach to introducing drive-in movies, and it has a bit enough of nostalgia in it for the people that experienced the drive-in theater days.
Right, with the intermissions and what have you. So which films are going to be in the set?
Giant Spider, The Cold, Alpha, Rana, Nightmare, maybe Invasion. We haven't cut that yet.
Yeah, I'll definitely be looking forward to that. Next, we have The Capture of Bigfoot, which is really more actually The Capture of the Yeti, if you go by the script. Tell us about this one. It actually came pretty late for the early 70s Bigfoot film cycle / obsession.
Well, you know, a lot of people had a good theatrical run. They liked it. I don't know why, but it was meant to be more of adventure film for family entertainment. There was, as you can see, nothing, monster or blood and guts in it. We did have the first picture of all pictures where we had unsurmountable problems.
I was going to get to that. Because first of all, I was going to say about the film itself. Again, you have Buck Flowers on hand.
and that I thought this one worked a lot better than Rana, even though you're tackling about the same territory, which jives with what you're just saying about the orientation you were going for. But I also understand that you had some issues with the shoot relating to the extreme weather of that particular Wisconsin winter. So tell us about that.
Yeah, we had 20 below zero weather for over a week,
right,
and and about 3 or 4 feet of snow. And any walking of anybody through the snow, you had to make trails. I mean, it's just unaccessible. And it was all shot on the studio property. The entire picture was in the shot on the back lot. The prosthetics were, the moment we put them on inside, the moment you walked outside into the cold, the prosthetics would start melting on the inside from the sweat of the skin. Just to shoot whatever we had to do.
The cameras probably didn't work in that kind of weather, correct?
No, it was shot in Panavision. And we had every heater, Barney, every heating blanket, wherever we could get electricity on those things. It just didn't work right.
It's amazing you actually got it done. Another little known fact around this film, the guy you originally cast as Bigfoot was actually Uncle Elmer from the WWE, correct?
You know, I forgot his name. It was a big wrestler from Mississippi, a friend of John Goff's, who we called him Tiny Something. He arrived, and turns out that he had phlambitis.
Oh, that's swelling of your limbs and your knees joints.
And Dale Kuyper, who was a wonderful special effects artist that had never done a suit or a prosthetic for movies. So the suit, the Bigfoot suit arrived. It was humongous, but it was all made out of solid styrofoam, which did not move. Tiny Frazier was the actor. The rest, Tiny Frazier. We had to put him, lay him down on the ground, lay the suit on the floor, and then he had to crawl backwards into the suit, and then it took two guys to stand him up, let alone walk.
Wow. And then he had to go walk out in the snow.
Yeah, that was the first day of shooting. So no Bigfoot. And I looked at my producer friend from Canada, Janusz Rautkiewicz, who was a tall guy and good in size. I said, Janusz, guess what? You're going to be Bigfoot. This is no way. He'd never done anything like that before. So my daughter, who was the wardrobe person, told her to rip out every bit of hard styrofoam and just leave the skin and redo the suit for Janusz with just the skin. She did. And Janusz then took the part of Bigfoot because Tiny couldn't move. There was no way he could move with anything.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is there any footage of Tiny in costume in the film, or is it all his replacement?
Yeah, there is. There are a couple of shots. If you look carefully, it is much bigger and unmovable. In other words, any shot that is almost stationary, that would be him.
So what other problems did the weather and, you know, the time of year that you were filming this present to you during the filming of this?
Those two elements of prosthetics falling off, getting snowmobiles moved into the woods is another problem.
Right.
But then the dogs. We had a dog man from Rhinelander, Wisconsin, who had these dogs were always fighting with each other. Well, you couldn't make them work when you needed them. This is not a Hollywood dog team.
No, not at all. I found the film itself at least comparable to similar fare like Snow Beast, and I like the more homey touches you put in the script and the characterization again. And like I said, that's one thing I really like about indie film, that these aren't like hoity-toity actor types self-consciously using, you know, the Strasberg method and referencing Stanislavski to get them into character. These are just everyday folks showing up and basically being themselves. It feels more authentic in the end. And again, to me, it has more value and resonance on a humanistic level than the glossier path that Hollywood's foisting on the general public nowadays.
Well, I also, it's the first time in my life ever that I gave an investor overall say, Larry, I don't know if you remember the name Larry Woolner, Dimension Pictures.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Larry Woolner was the guy, by the way, who, together with Bill Shatner, sat in their screening room and had about 10 screenings of the giant spider invasion to come up with the idea of making Kingdom of the Spiders.
That's actually a film that I enjoy a lot as well, but it was actually derived from yours, eh?
That's how the idea came to Larry Woolner. Well, Larry Woolner came to Wisconsin during the middle of the blizzard shoot, and we had to bring him and his wife into the studio with a snowmobile.
Wow.
And he looked at the first cut of Bigfoot, and he made me a deal. He made a deal. He says, we get 30%, you get 70% worldwide, gross. I almost shit bricks because that's good to anybody.
It's a very good deal. It's a very good deal.
It's unbelievable that Larry Woolner would do such a thing.
Right.
So I went to my partner, the financier,
right,
and I said, Dan Stroik, I said, this is the deal. We've got to take it. He says, Billy's is if there's one guy that was willing to make it, just think what how many other guys were going to make a deal than that. He didn't make the deal.
No.
He decided to put 50 prints on his credit card and just himself.
Wow.
And I was getting into distribution at the time. I called my bookers, Mickey Zeid in Detroit, and I said, Mickey, I got a picture for you. Who said, yeah, we'll open it in 50 theaters in Detroit. And he says, what about the advertising money? And I looked at my friend Dan. I said, what about the advertising money? He says, I don't have any money left.
Oh.
The picture opened in Detroit in 50 theaters with 50 expensive prints and no advertising. I mean, it was a disaster. However, Zeid made some money still. We got pretty close to zero. The second opening was already set in Denver.
Right.
I had another theater in Denver who was ready to book it, so we shipped, I think, 30 prints to Denver.
Right.
But no advertising. And the distributor in Denver put up the money for the advertising, and there was zero reports for us. And that's how kind of it went over the nation until my friend Dan Stroy came there and says, Bill, he says, you did a hell of a job. The picture went $200,000 over budget, and we haven't seen a dime.
Wow. Well, you know, that's what happens when you get greedy, I guess. You should have taken the deal. That was an incredible deal he offered you.
Yeah, and I wrote that in my book, Film Funding 2000, one day. The experience, I said, never let an investor have say in the business end or the final word on anything.
Right. Coming up, we'll be discussing Demons of Ludlow, The Cold, Tiny Tim and Blood Harvest, Bankruptcy, and current projects only here on Third Eye Cinema. Now we get to what's probably my favorite of your films, Demons of Ludlow. You know, the atmosphere and the feel of this one are so off-kilter. It's like a nightmare on film. I mean, the idea of the cursed piano seems strange, but it really worked, and it was very much akin to John Carpenter's The Fog with Counting to Recurse. But it was actually a lot creepier with the old warlock and his evil colonial ghost coming back to seek revenge. And I really liked how the ostensible lead actually wound up dead, while the only one who escaped was the girl reporter. It has a lot of the same feel as films from the time like Lamora, Lady Dracula, or Messiah of Evil. It's very eerie and disturbingly off-center. I was actually very surprised that it came out in 1983, because I would have thought from watching it that it would have been the product of hippie types rethinking the whole bicentennial thing back in 1976.
Well, no, that was a pleasure shoot. And the reason we had just before that, we had put up our 40 by 70 by 60 soundstage. And I was determined to have, in this one, total control over every aspect of production. So I built all the sets on the stage with an aisle in the middle, the sets to the side.
Right.
Arranged it in such a way that I could just move through with one dolly and whatever angles we needed to move
right.
through from one set to another and do it.
Wow.
It was a phenomenal, total controllable experience. And therefore, the only weakness I find in it is the mayor in the opening scenes. He was a little stiffened.
That's true.
Otherwise, I hope it worked.
I really think it did. And when I had mentioned I'd seen it for the first time a couple months ago, and I was amazed at this film, that wow, I've never seen this film before, and it's this good. And I had mentioned it to some friends, and one of them piped in right away. He's like, oh, I love that film. That's one of my favorites. I haven't seen it in years. So, you know, you do have an audience for this. That was really a good film. There's a lot of atmosphere to that that even in your other films isn't really present because they're more of like a sci-fi type thing. This really was, like I said, it was like a wide-awake nightmare. It really has an interesting feel to it, and I thought it worked really well.
Well, that's very gratifying to hear that there's some...
After this, you put out an oddity with The Game, which was recently released on one of those multi-pack DVD sets under the title The Cold. Now, what was with the shift to slapstick comedy in the last reel? Because it was really quite effective before that change, and the change is quite jarring.
It's called Outside Influences. Yeah, that was a little brain fart, as I call it, that we, one day with my English friend Alan Rayner, who played that Quasimodo part.
Right.
Who was a real pain. He was always a pain in the ass on the set. But he had a bit of influence on it with this Quasimodo part. We thought as well maybe a little humor would help and stuff. But that was shot in a week, the whole thing. One location, I thought it definitely was the cheapest picture I've made. It was a brainstorm between two guys.
Right.
Let's do it, because it was fun.
Right.
And we had Asian, we had the cast, and said, let's just do it, and shoot it off the hip. There was basically no script. I shot it, three-man crew. We just breezed through it and put it in the can because our distributor at the time, Intertranscontinental Pictures, Israel Shakid, needed a picture, so we did it, and it was an El Cheapo effort. In and out.
It's interesting that you mentioned that it was an Englishman that put in that comedy influence, because I was going to say that Pete Walker did very much the same thing with his final film, Bloodbath in the House of Death, where any of the suspense or atmosphere that he had built was undermined by his insistence on playing it for camp and unmasking everyone in the last reel like Scooby-Doo. So do you think the film accomplished what you wanted it to do? Because I would think that the market for a more serious horror film would feel cheated by the denouement, and those looking for something more lighthearted would be turned off by the apparent grimness of tone from the first half.
I don't think that accomplished what I wanted to accomplish. I really don't. The quirkiness in the end is what kind of destroyed it.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, if you didn't have that, if you chopped off whatever it was the last 20 minutes or so, it worked pretty well. And then all of a sudden, it's like, what's going on? You know, I was almost expecting the goofy music. Actually, I think you did have the goofy music popping up, like a Keystone Cops kind of a thing. Like, what's happening here? It's only another
direction. You can never look back and say, look at the stupid stuff we did. And I do it all the time. When you look at something in retrospect, there's always some weaknesses, or you can't figure out, why in the hell did we do this? Allow it to happen.
Right. But at the moment, it seemed like a good idea. But at least you went out there and did this and created these films. So, you know, the fact that one of them has a strange part in it, or some guy was drunk or whatever happens, doesn't really count as much as the fact that this is out there and you can enjoy it and accept it for what it is, or laugh at it, or whatever you want to do. And you actually went out and did something, because a lot of people don't even get to that point. You know, they think they want to be a screenwriter or a musician or whatever, and then they just end up working in a 9-to-5 job and forget about it. It's a dream that never gets fulfilled. So you actually went out there and made these things, and that says a lot right there.
Well, and with film, it was a little more difficult than taking a digital camera and assembling a cast. And the film technique and lighting and everything,
right,
took so much time and effort to even, besides trying to stick to a storyline or have a plot of some sort. You had all these things with the... And well, we all know how Hollywood does pictures, and how we did pictures in Europe with a studio where you have a staff of 50 and everything at your disposal. This is usually these were one-man shows.
Exactly. After 1984, you left filmmaking for a bit to handle international distribution of those Don Knotts, Tim Conway comedies, like, I guess, The Private Eyes, those sort of things. You shifted focus and career orientation several times. You were actually quite a restless guy, weren't you?
Well, you know, I made a picture about 5 years ago for a friend of mine who came in with an idea. It was initially called Evil Secrets, and I shit canned it totally,
right,
sitting on the shelf. And 5 years later, I looked at the footage. It was done in digital, by the way.
Right.
It's spent a great deal of time on it. Sherry Kaffar, I don't know, you probably remember.
Ginger, yeah.
Sherry was a dear friend of mine for years and years and years. And she called me up one day. It's a funny story. Bill, can you still make a picture for low budget? I said, sure. And she came up with the story, but the prerequisite was that she stars in it.
Right.
But I had seen Sherry for 20 years and had no heart to say no to an old friend. And so we started this and we did it. We basically put it in a can, and looking at the rushes and the daily footage, it kept getting worse and worse. Sherry was no longer the ingenue, the sex pot, and the leading lady that she was 20 years ago.
Exactly. It's been a lot of years.
It just, some things that just looked totally out of place would never fly, and I put it on the shelf. Now, 6 years later, I've been looking at some of the footage, and we had an ingenue playing opposite her who turned out to be excellent and just a wonderful talent out of the local gal that turned out to be a real, real star, I think.
Right.
So I'm looking at footage and have rewritten the script using the flashback technique and make it a ghost story, a haunting story, paranormal. It is called The Ghost and Amy Hill.
So when is that going to come out?
A riveting, it's kind of a riveting paranormal story that is all in basically in one house location again,
right,
but with lots of stuff happening and more in a Hitchcockian style. And that we're sitting on, we're promoting it right now to get first a trailer done and get a cast together and shoot it in June this year, called The Ghost and Amy Hill. I think that might have some legs, both for television, international, but theatrical, I don't have much hope for them.
Exactly. When you came back to filmmaking, you continued in a more lighthearted vein with Twister's Revenge, where you've got like dopey hillbilly types and a kit from Knight Rider style talking monster truck of all things. So why move away from the sort of sci-fi horror films you're generally known for to this sort of fare?
Well, I was finally getting to stuff that I really wanted to do. Comedy, humor, and musicals, really. That was the thrust of everything, except I got sidetracked with horror sci-fi stuff.
Did the film do well for you? Because it almost feels made for television. It's really quite askew from what most viewers familiar with Bill Rabane would expect.
Yeah, it sure is. We're very lucky. The moment the picture was in the can, I sold it for the entire production cost to a German distributor for Germany only. And it played in Germany in theaters. It opened with, I think, 60, 70 screens. And the distributor since then has passed away. I have all the rights and materials. In retrospect, again, I saw a lot of weaknesses in it. The most objections came from this stupid scene that we put in, an impromptu thing with the bar scene and lovebirds. That had to go. So I went back to my own thinking, the original, which was without part of that scene. And we redid it as Dumb, Dumb, and Dumber. Because to me, when I screened it just a few months ago and did this, I said, this is so dumb, it's super dumb.
Right.
And we just call it that.
And you're probably also marketing to the crowd that was into like Dumb and Dumber, that movie that was popular a couple years back.
You know, I never even thought of that. It just appeared to me that it's, pardon my French, but so freaking stupid. Character Bear, but I still have to laugh at his... It's humor from days gone by, really.
Next, you did a reel about face, like we were talking about earlier, with the creepy slasher film Blood Harvest with none other than Tiny Tim in it. He was quite an interesting character. How did you get together with him, and what led you to cast him as the red herring simpleton Marvelous Mervo in the film?
Well, another turn in events and brain parts.
Right.
It's like, Tiny was in a concert that I promoted on the premises of the studio one year.
Right.
And he became such a wonderful, first of all, he was a very wonderful human being, just a great guy. And I thought when I first was presented with a script that was nothing like what it turned out to be.
Right.
He needed a central character that was weird,
pretty
weird, and Tiny fit the bill.
That's for sure.
Ask him, he was absolutely elated. He wanted to do it. The problem was that Tiny could not act. He was a star when nonstop singing or anything performance-wise, he was a star.
Right.
Acting-wise, he had inhibitions and he could not express himself. So there again, I was convinced that he was the right character for it. And we worked together very closely. He lived at the studio for a long time in an apartment. And we massaged it and went over every scene and explained the character and what have you. And he pulled it off, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I've got to say he...
Well, we gave... I think it was predictable in a sense. But I thought it was okay because of the other elements in it.
Exactly.
And the angle between his brother and...
Right. And I got to say that Tim might be the most terrifying clown ever committed to celluloid immortality. And he was really creepy.
Yeah, he fell into the part. The moment he had the clown makeup on, he had less problems of...
Self-consciousness.
With his, it was very interesting how that worked, the character. But I think it's in his particular part stands out. It's an unforgettable part for Tiny Tim.
Exactly. And you'd also cast a particularly attractive young lady in this film who appears to have been quite comfortable displaying her body.
Not in the beginning. Leszek Brzezinski and I had to use every effort to explain to her that... This is the movies. We should have some nudity in here. Today, I just asked my wife, who's an editor and edited a lot of stuff for 35 years.
Right.
We were just debating the issue of how much nudity and is that scene really essential and how much should be in there. But nudity does not offend me.
No, not at all. It's actually a good thing. I think that's what it is. It's the difference between the typical American attitude where they seem to be all for the violence and the blood and guts, which I don't really care for, despite the kind of films that I enjoy, and the European attitude, which is like, you know, so they're nude, they're having sex, so what? You know, there's nothing wrong with it. And that's the way I feel as well. You know, all these sexploitation films, like we watch Something Weird films a lot. And yet you say something like that to most people and they'll be like, oh, you know, and they start freaking out and they start thinking about, you know, the children or whatever. It's very strange. I don't understand why it's okay for those same people and their kids and whatever to watch something like, even something like Fight Club, which is very violent, and, you know, Saw and things like that are just twisted. And yet you show them something that's got some erotic content in it, especially if it's just something like, you know, with Blood Harvest with the nude scenes, and they'll get really uptight about it. I don't really understand that. And maybe it's, I was born and raised here, but I always had more of a European orientation, probably because of the kind of films that I used to watch. And I think it's not very common, unfortunately. You know, there's a definite difference. A lot of that stuff doesn't fly over here. And it's disturbing to me to this day that people are still like this. In this day and age, where it's more or less anything goes, people are still in that kind of mentality. I don't get it.
Well, Americans grow up traditionally in an environment of this type. Conversely speaking, of, you know, hiding a nude body, that's something that is not allowed. Even though you can watch any daytime soap opera, for God's sake, and all they're doing is throwing sex and sex and sex at you.
Exactly, but even it's strange. Because it's still, they're still going to be clothed somehow, or, you know.
Even implied, the implied sex is sometimes worse than the real thing.
Exactly. Do you think it's because, I mean, this is an old argument, and I'm never really sure how much people are just projecting onto this one. It seems a little far-fetched. But do you think it's because this country was initially founded by groups like the Puritans, that mentality has never really left, and, you know, it's still sort of infecting us?
Yeah, but the Puritans came from Europe.
Right.
From Central Europe.
But they were defecting from there. They wanted to get away from it because that was too much for them. They wanted to establish something new. And it seems
I even remember in Germany in 1945, between 45 and 59, the moment German press started bringing out their weekly and monthly magazines and what have you, they had covers of nude, fully nude women on it. It was on the newsstands for everybody to see, including three-year-old kids.
Exactly.
No issue was ever made of it. It was just, so what? There's a nude picture.
Exactly. And even England for years with the Page Three girls. I mean, they just recently stopped that because of, I think it was like a feminist outcry. But,
have,
you know, for years.
It's
just like,
have you ever been to Cannes?
No, I would love to go, but I know about it.
You know, the biggest attraction there for Americans, the Europeans just take it for granted that all the girls, the topless bathers there, that all day long you can see them on the beaches.
Exactly.
That ones that get their chairs as close to them as possible are the Americans.
Exactly. We had done some trips to the Virgin Islands at one point, And it was the same thing, you know, going to the nude beaches and the topless beaches. And you would see people that were really uptight about this, and other ones were like, hey, you know, let's check this out. Why not? But there's usually it's either the people that are scared of it or the people that have the real prurient interest, like, oh, yeah, you know, they're getting really excited about it, as opposed to people who are like, yeah, so what? You know, why not? Get some sun.
Maybe we wouldn't have the crime problem that we have today
exactly.
in America if there was more of it.
Exactly.
And
it's true.
I'm not a psychologist, but talking about women or nudity, prostitution may be good for America.
You know, there's definitely an argument for it, because the fact that so many things are so repressed, where you can do it behind closed doors but don't let anybody know, I mean, that's just breeding this mentality of secrets and, oh, I can't let anybody know. And it actually breeds like sort of a perversion that you don't really find in Europe, because it's more just like, okay, yeah, so, you know, you do that. And it doesn't mean anything. It's very casual.
Isn't it strange that in Italy, much of the prostitution was basically for the benefit of the Catholic Church in
right.
Italy?
Anyway, getting back to Blood Harvest, you know, this girl, she had a rather prominent, if endearing, Eastern European accent. And I believe this is actually her only film role. So how did you find her?
She was a referral by a friend to a Wisconsin and Milwaukee family.
Right.
Who they sent a picture. Her mother came with for every audition and meeting we had at the studio. Her mother was with her.
Right.
Actually, very conservative family. So to talk, and Leszek Brzezinski did most of it. He had a nice British accent. He sounded very serious. He discussed it with the issue with them, and finally it was no longer an issue. She was
right.
hesitant, but frankly, I think she liked it.
Well, it comes across that way on film. I was surprised that you had mentioned that initially she was very reserved, because, you know, she seems very casual and open about it, and, you know, she has a very appealing figure, so it was a pleasant viewing.
Yeah, well, not having dealt with nudity in any of the pictures before, it was the first for two things, both graphic violence and nudity. The question is, does it work?
Well,
and
I thought it did. I mean, you know, the violence end, you have to speak to somebody else. I mean, I do enjoy slasher films and horror films, but I'm not really there for that. So that's kind of incidental to me, which is strange. I know most people just go into it for the gore or something. But, you know, I'm there more for the atmosphere and whatever else. But the nudity definitely works. I was very happy to see someone that had a body like that, you know, very comfortable about displaying it, at least on screen.
Have you seen some of the Herschel Lewis stuff?
Oh, yeah. I love Herschel's films.
You have? Well, I remember the few I saw in the very early days, right after he made them, I was shocked and appalled by stuff that he did.
Right. Well, he was a pioneer.
But Herschel was somewhat of an enigmatic character. I think Herschel Lewis had a tremendous talent and was an incredible filmmaker, since he knew he could be a one-man crew and do everything needed to be done.
Exactly.
He had a lot of talent. He didn't have to, in my opinion, he never had to do the stuff he did. He could have made mainstream Hollywood fare anytime he wanted to.
But again, to this day, would we still be talking about him if he did? I mean, they might be talking about him vaguely, like, you know, when people mention Douglas Sirk or one of the more obscure but, you know, critically celebrated directors out there. But, you know, most people don't even know who that is. Whereas, even to the average cult film fan, you say Herschel Gordon Lewis, and they go, wow.
Yeah, well, Herschel had no scruples when it came to that. There's a story. I hired him as a cameraman for an industrial film, for an FBI-connected bank training film. I think it was in the early 70s. And we were shooting a scene. Keep in mind, this is a protection training film for bank tellers, to prevent bank crimes and bank robberies. So we're working with the FBI and other law enforcement agencies, and I was on location shoot in Illinois, and
right.
I needed some extra production cars. So
right.
Herschel, of course, knows how to fix anything in production. I got the production cars for you. So we rented three or four production cars from him.
Right.
Well, it turned out during the production that he was involved in a ring of car rental operation with stolen cars.
Ooh, okay.
That caused him, I think that was the cause why he had to leave Chicago.
Ah, I have no idea about that one.
It was not very kosher, the situation. The cars we were using for a law enforcement
exactly.
project.
You did finally stop film production at this point due to health issues. So what have you been up to in the intervening years after you had recovered? Because I understand that you wrote two books and you ran for political office.
Yes, I did all of that, but I had a stroke in 88. It took about 3 years to recover, and the president of the studio at the same time, the same guy that played Quasimodo, so to say, in The Cold, was the president, Alan Rayner. He had no idea of how the studio financially functioned. My wife and I were always guarantors, so to say, for a bank and anything the studio did. So at the time of my illness, we personally had just come back from the major festivals and markets in the world and put all these expenses on our credit cards. So we were basically broke.
Ooh.
And Alan Rayner screamed out, well, we have a terrible situation. We never know. We don't know if Bill is coming back or not. And nobody really knew. We have to file bankruptcy. Long story short, the lawyer was hired. He decided it was a good idea to put the studio into bankruptcy. The only thing he knows that was the wrong party to go bankrupt. The studio was in fine shape. It had substantial assets, had no debts. My wife and I had the debts. So the lawyer filed bankruptcy for the studio instead of myself and my wife, which the lawyer abandoned after 2 years. And when I came back to the real world, I kept asking, why are we bankrupt?
Right.
Well, why should we be bankrupt? So I took over the bankruptcy fight on my own without legal representation. And the whole thing kind of just blossomed into a 9-year-long bankruptcy.
Ow.
That took everything.
Horrible.
If the main subject of all my writings today is on American justice and idiocy. Because that's what it was. Because the bank that held as collateral basically most of the negatives, the bank, a small bank in Lincoln County, Wisconsin, didn't know what the heck negatives are. At the very end of the bankruptcy, they took all the negatives and prints, all film materials, or most film materials, put in that dump, took it to the local dump, disposing of their own collateral.
How did you get your prints back?
I didn't. Some of the negatives are lost. Films that were in labs were, and in other people's possession, I received back. There's Alpha, Giant Spiders, and prints that can be used for HD, Demons of the Cold, Twister's Revenge. But the rest, the original negatives are all gone.
Wow. Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah, that's something that is still hard to get over with.
Yeah, I can imagine. Just to change the topic, I understand that now you're actually working on a musical of the Giant Spider Invasion. Yeah, this sounds hilarious. Tell us about this one.
Well, that was not my idea. It was my agent for 20 years, and Dave Jackson Artists in Kansas City. We were kicking around ideas for projects, and the project of why not make a musical about Giant Spider Invasion came up. And without my even pursuing that, he contacted some music writers that he handled in Washington, the state of Washington, and they start getting in touch with me and writing a score or the main songs. And the group did. They went ahead and for over 8 months started writing with lots of telephone conversations. It turned out that we have a CD out right now of about 16 songs that tell the story of the making of Giant Spider Invasion.
Wow.
Very few humorous, funny, and it would make a great stage play. Simple, very simple. It's got it has a lot of stuff, the Busby Berkeley type musical reviews and stuff. And I wrote the script, which is kind of ready to go, and I think we have to make it a musical stage production first, and then shoot the stage production with 3 or 4 cameras, and then clean up afterwards and do the wraparound that I wrote. We would basically have a huge production value product in the can within 2 or 1 week of shooting.
Wow. So between that and what you mentioned about the HD remasters and the box set that you want to put out of most of your films, you got a lot of exciting stuff coming up here on tap.
We got a handful going, and it's like a 24/7 operation.
So is there anything else that you wanted to address? Anything, any other projects coming up?
Well, right now we're shooting a docudrama called Silver Street and the Lotta Morgan Story, which is a fascinating local region. It's a regional project which has some national possibilities because the character in question is a lady by the name of Lotta Morgan, whose story was written by famous author Edna Ferber in 1905, and MGM made a picture about her called Come and Get It, which won an Academy Award in 1936. Lotta Morgan was a prostitute in Hurley, Wisconsin in the 1870s.
Right.
And she was brutally murdered with an axe to her head in 1890. And the murder was never solved. Highly political and very bizarre. Her picture, her image, is seen on every lamppost in Hurley, Wisconsin. It was somehow loved character in this area. So that story has now been put into script form.
Right.
I've been shooting this for the last 4 months.
Right.
And it's a fascinating story that has some national possibilities.
Well, with that, Bill, I'd like to thank you for joining us here on Third Eye Cinema, and we'd love to have you back in the future to discuss any upcoming projects you have on tap.
Gene, it was a pleasure. It's a real pleasure talking to you, and thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, very much appreciate you speaking with you.
Lufta, it was a pleasure, Gene. Thank you so much for having me, and you did you covered all the bases, actually.
Well, thank you. I try. Best of luck to you with all these projects, and definitely keep me posted.
Thank you, and we'll be in touch. All right, take care.
Hello, everyone. This is Mark Polonia.
And this is Tim Ritter.
And you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Be there or be square.
Hi, everybody. I am Grand Master of Martial Arts. My name is Y.K. Kim. And I truly appreciate for your interview that Third Eye Cinema. You are a great interviewer. I could not believe. And you are a great communicator. You made me so comfortable. That's great. I want everybody, at least the ones watch my connection, and I really appreciate all audience as listens to Third Eye Cinema.
Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoyed our up close and personal interview with Bill Rodin. Next week, on week 43 of Third Eye Cinema, Ronnie James Dio himself come back from beyond the grave. Powerhouse vocalist Diego Valdez for a Argentinian traditional metal band Chalker. If you'd like to contact us here, comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker, musician, and like to hear us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com, visit our website, thirdeyecinema.wordpress.com, or our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema, but we've got the Big Pop Online Network.
Diego Valdez, singer from Hello, I'm Diego Valdez, singer of... Hello, I'm Diego Valdez, singer of Helker, and you are listening Third Eye Cinema. Hello, this is Diego Valdez, singer of Helker, and you are listening Third Eye Cinema. Stay tuned.
If you missed any part of this or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our website or Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Block Talk Radio shows are available for archive listen or download at your convenience.